We're talking about remarkable women scientists here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. Some were recognized with the Nobel Prize for their pioneering contributions, but most aren't household names. They're physicists and chemists, biologists, physicians who were well ahead of their time, and their inventions have impacted our world. Are you a woman working in a traditionally male-dominated field, like, say, in medicine or in the sciences? What has your experience been like? Join in at 800-642-1234, any point throughout the hour. Catherine Whitlock is a science journalist. She holds a doctorate in immunology and is a member of the British Society for Immunology. She is co-author of the new book called 10 Women Who Changed Science and the World. Marie Curie, Rita Levi-Montalcini, Chien-Yung Wu, Virginia Apgar, and more. Trailblazers, pioneers, and revolutionaries. Catherine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I think the title of your book forces us to say these names out loud, right? Maybe they will stick. So I think your title has ulterior motives.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it was supposed to jump out at people and just remind people of the power of these women and what they did. Absolutely.
Why don't more of these women, these 10 women that you feature, why don't they have more name recognition? Why don't we know them?
Well, I think one of the things is that they lived and worked in a time where women in science was so unusual. And so they were such a minority that and nobody was shouting about them then. So I think to be able to shout about them now was a big part of why we wrote this book. And, you know, nowadays, a number of people have said to me, why didn't you write about living scientists? Well, I think the living scientists get a certain amount of publicity. We live in a world where Twitter feeds and Facebook and so on just allow us to know about these people. But we were so keen to point out that women had been in science really since science has existed as a discipline. And we wanted to highlight their stories because they illustrate so much about what's important to succeed actually in any area of life, not only in science, as a woman.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You pick these women, as you said, who have passed, and they were born around the same time in a given like 12-year span in the early 1900s. How did you choose to include these particular 10 people?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was hard because the pool of female scientists is small, but there are still some amazing women there. So there was a couple of key things. One was we hit upon a nice round number of 10 because the kind of length of book that we were writing meant that we could present enough detail, but also have some breadth across the different sciences. So as you mentioned in your introduction, we have chosen physicists, chemists, biologists, medics, environmental scientists across a whole area of science. And also the other big factor was trying to have different nationalities in there. There are a certain number of Americans, great for your country, but we also wanted to feature, there are a couple of British women, a Chinese, an Italian, a bit of a mixture. So it was about producing breadth and depth at the same time.
I wonder, did they know each other's work at all? Were they supportive of each other in any way? Did they ever overlap at all?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think the short answer is no, mainly for these women. I would think probably a slight exception with one of the British scientists, Dorothy Hodgkin. She worked in the field of X-ray crystallography, and she was working on how to understand the structure of important biological molecules. So I think one or two of the other women who worked in similar fields, for example, Gertrude Elion, who was designing new drugs, she would have been aware of Dorothy's work because of the overlap in their fields. But I think, again, because of the publicity issue and because we were covering different scientists, by and large, their work was not well known even to other scientists. And I think even, you know, a scientist writing this book, I'm, you know, slightly ashamed to admit, but I'd only heard of several of them before I started researching because they're just not so well known at all.
We're talking about unsung women scientists who changed our world through their research. Catherine Whitlock's book is called 10 Women Who Changed Science in the World. And we're meeting some of these women. Who are your favorite female scientists throughout history? Were Marie Curie or Rachel Carson your role models as a kid? Why? How did they shape your life? We're at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Well, Catherine, let's look at some of these scientists. Can you first tell us about Dr. Virginia Apgar, who spent some of her time in Wisconsin, has a Wisconsin connection, in her residency? What did she do for newborns?
So she was an amazing woman. She with a great deal of difficulty, got in to train as a medic, train as a doctor. And she was one of the first, in fact, I think the first female obstetrician in the US, and she was fascinated by the scenario when babies are first born. All the attention at the time, and we're going back to the 1930s in America, and this would have been the same worldwide, but all the attention seemed to be focused on the mother. And the baby was born and kind of whisked away and slightly left on one side. I mean, I mean that almost quite literally. And she was asked by a young student in the cafeteria one day, you know, how do we look after these newborns? We're worrying about the mother's health and what's happening to her, which is, of course, very important. But how do we judge how well these newborns are doing? And she came up with this very simple score, which is now called the Apgar score. And that just simply looks at things like how well the babies are breathing and their muscle tone and the color of their skin. And these simple little checks, five checks with a basic score given to them, has revolutionized the care of newborns. And it was that little score that's now used widely. I've got three children. It was used on my children.
Used on mine too, yeah.
And so now it's used widely as just a simple, very quick check in the, you know, chaos after a baby's born, to check that the newborn doesn't need extra ventilation or help with its breathing, all these kind of crucial things that have led to the development of intensive care units for babies. And she literally has saved thousands of babies' lives, but because of it.
Do we know anything about Virginia's bedside manner or how she was with these newborns? Did she love babies?
Yeah, well, I think she loved people, actually. That's a big thing that comes across. And that's there were themes for all these women, threads that ran through all their stories. And I think one of the stories that comes across about her is how good she was with people, not only newborns, but patients in general. And she had a fantastic bedside manner. So she was great at talking to fellow doctors or patients. And that really helped her communicate her ideas to the medical community.
And she became the first female board certified anesthesiologist in 1937. Yeah. How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, I think obviously a lot of this is down to her work with the Apgar score. She published early on and was eventually accepted as somebody in her own right, as somebody who was, you know, first and foremost a doctor. And it was that persistence. Again, this is a theme that comes from comes across in the other women. It's that persistence that allowed her to be recognised, and, you know, in many ways put her head above the parapet. Obstetricians were a new thing generally, and certainly to have a woman on board was amazing. So yeah, she was very much a first from that point of view.
The book is called 10 Women Who Changed Science and the World. Author Catherine Whitlock stays with us. What do you think can be done to make the sciences more open and accessible for women and people from all backgrounds? If you work in the sciences or in a STEM career, what made your career possible? Who made your career possible? What enabled you to succeed? Do you have a woman scientist who is a role model today? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your story. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's women scientists who changed our world. This hour of the morning show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the scientific achievements of women. Marie Curie may be top of mind. She devoted her life to understanding radioactivity, and she was held in high regard, high esteem by scientists around the world. She won the Nobel twice, and since the Nobel Prizes were founded over a century ago, 19 women have won the prize in science. Are you a woman working in the sciences? What made your career possible? Who made your career possible and enabled you to succeed? What do you want women considering a career in STEM fields to know? Join in the conversation this hour, 800-642-1234. Tell us about your work and the scientists for whom you admire. Catherine Whitlock stays with us. Her new book is called 10 Women Who Changed Science and the World, and we're hearing their stories this hour. Catherine, going back to Virginia Apgar, how did she go from tending to these newborns to her work at the March of Dimes and understanding birth defects?
Yeah, so this was, so she became very interested. She had a huge number of experience of witnessing a number of different births. And she was, again, noticing that the care of babies that were born with congenital conditions, so conditions that had developed in the womb, was really not what it should have been. And so she gradually moved sideways into not only researching what was important for the care of these babies, but also looking at the social context. She was very keen on making sure that these babies were looked after properly in the community and not, as she put it, dumped in homes. You know, parents were encouraged not to look after their children. And so she became a big part of that social movement to look after these babies. And the March of Dimes was a fantastically successful fundraising campaign for all sorts of things, actually. Vaccination is a big issue nowadays. And again, you know, raising money for these campaigns was part of her job. I mean, she, like many of these women, was really a polymath. She had lots of different interests, and she was able to draw on the skills that she got from her different interests to really put forward her ideas about the care of these babies.
I feel like I get whiplash when I read her life and picking up degrees here and there, really moving between different areas of hard science, like not easy things to master. It's really remarkable.
No. She was fantastic. She was very humble in many ways. You know, you mentioned she went back and retrained later on in understanding genetics and all the important things that feed into the care of the newborn. And she recognized that she didn't always know what she needed to know. She had a kind of humble streak to her that put her in the right position, right frame of mind to take on board more information. I mean, she was intensely curious, of course, another trait that all these women bear, the ability to turn her mind to anything intellectually, you know, fantastic.
Always moving, always doing something. How was she as a person? Could she sit still?
No, exactly. And you know, she there's some lovely stories that we managed to get hold of about all her different interests. You know, she made musical instruments on the side. I mean, not only did she play them, but make them, she played them. And there's a fantastic story about her worrying about finding the right kind of wood to build the back of her, I think it was a viola, and she suddenly spied it in the hospital phone box in the foyer of the hospital and asked permission to use this particular piece of beautiful maple to use on her new instrument. And of course they denied her permission, so this is not one to repeat at home, as they say, but in the middle of the night she snuck in with a friend and replaced this beautiful piece of maple with something that looked rather similar and took the maple out and used it to make her instrument. But you know, that the kind of, we put stories like that in because we felt that they brought these women to life. I mean, they didn't take an awful lot to bring them to life because they were so fascinating. But you know, it's a story, it's not specifically about her scientific life, but it all feeds into how she thought and how she, you know, she was prepared to go against authority, rightly or wrongly, and you know, push the field forward. And in her case, making a musical instrument.
I think she was entitled in the hospital. I mean, she was working hard enough and doing a lot of work that she was entitled to take that wood. We're talking with Catherine Whitlock. She is co-author of the book, 10 Women Who Changed Science and the World. And you can join in with your role models as a kid, your role models in science right now at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's talk now about a totally different world for Dr. Rita Levi-Montalcini, who was in Italy and in an environment of fascism. She discovered nerve growth factor. What is that?
So nerve growth factor is, in fact, it was the first growth factor to be discovered. So in essence, it's one of the most important molecules that's involved in driving the development of the immune system. So going all the way back to the embryonic stage in utero, in the womb, as the nervous system develops, it uses this molecule to guide the development of the nerve cells that transmit nervous impulses. And she was an absolutely fascinating woman. She worked, as you said, in fascist Italy, an incredibly difficult time. She came from a Jewish family. And as Mussolini came to power, it became increasingly difficult to work. So she not only had to cope with the difficulties of working in science as a woman, but she was a Jew living in fascist Italy, and she essentially escaped to the hills. But nothing stopped her. So she carried on working even under these difficult conditions. And there were some lovely stories about her working in her, really her bedroom effectively became a laboratory. But she found every single possible tool or assistance that she could from weird and wonderful sources. So yeah. She used
what kind of tools was she using in her home to conduct her experiments?
So thinking of tools, she used, she approached the local optician. I don't know what he would have been called then, the local guy who tested eyes, and borrowed tiny little pairs of tweezers and various weird and wonderful instruments that he had in his shop, and adapted them. So she was operating on chick embryos, so in the eggs that she would collect from the farmyard. And of course, it was a time when food was very scarce, and so much to her family's horror, after she'd operated on the eggs and studied the pattern of nerve growth in these embryos. She put the remains of an egg in a frying pan and served them to her family for supper, which caused a certain amount of horror. But, you know, food was scarce, needs must. Right. So she was fantastic from that point of view. And she was one of my favourite scientists, I have to say, actually. She partly because of how long she lived. She lived till she was 103.
103, and a very outspoken woman. I mean, she really put it out there with her personality.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, she was a fiery character, didn't always suffer fools gladly, and she was somebody who was probably pretty well known in her time. I mean, she only died, I think, in 2003. So she was quite a public figure, partly because she was outspoken, partly because she'd lived so long. And that there's a lovely saying that people in Italy would only recognize the Pope, the head of the Catholic Church, if he was standing next to Rita. She was out there. Yeah.
Her family, they were eventually forced to flee their homes, live under assumed identities as Catholics. What was that period in Florence like for Rita and her family?
Yeah, very, very difficult. She was trained as a medic. So when World War II actually broke out, she ended up, in fact, in both World Wars, I think, she ended up really returning to her training as a medic, although much of her, what she's known for is her work with science and nerve growth factor. But she actually went to work on the front lines. All of these women actually who were working in the World War II in Europe somehow or other got involved in the war effort. And she was very much, I mean, I think, you know, it was a very traumatic experience. Many of the stories only came out afterwards, of course. But yes, I think, you know, she was dealing with an awful lot to deal with all these troubles and to deal with carrying on with her work. I mean, you know, it was incredible, really.
How do we still see the impact of her work today in science?
Yeah, so I think she set up a huge institution in Italy. In fact, she did a lot of work in Italy and America. And her science opened up the whole field of cell biology and how embryos develop and how important growth factors are. As I say, hers was the first one to be discovered, nerve growth factor. But it's turned out, like, you know, it's one of the reasons we wrote about women who are no longer alive, because you get the context. And nerve growth factor is now implicated in the development of all sorts of diseases, things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So she not only influenced women and how women work in science, but she also influenced her field massively.
Talking with Catherine Whitlock, she's our guide as we look at women trailblazers in science. The new book is called 10 Women Who Change Science and the World. What can be done to make more of an on-ramp for sciences and STEM careers for women and people from all backgrounds? If you work in the sciences, what made your career possible? Who enabled you to succeed? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Coming up, we'll learn about a physicist, Lise Meitner, who pioneered nuclear fission. In the early 90s, the heaviest known element in the universe was named in her honor. It's her story. More on women in science after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about women trailblazers in science on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're learning about the lesser-known scientists who made outstanding accomplishments to their field of physics and chemistry and biology and medicine and so many different other STEM fields, the likes of chemist Marie Curie, who you may recognize from her two Nobel Prizes, and physicist Xianxiang Wu, who you may not know, also under the radar, Virginia Apgar, who helped newborns thrive, as we've learned, and biologist Rita Levi-Montalcini, the so-called Lady of the Cells, who died in 2012. She did neurobiological research in her bedroom as fascism in World War II raged around her. Listen to her approach to challenges.
Difficulty give a possibility to use it to the best what you have capacity.
Difficulty gives possibility to use the best of your capacity. Who are your favorite female scientists throughout history? Were Marie Curie or Rachel Carson your role models as a kid? Why is that? How did they shape your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. The book is 10 Women Who Changed Science. Author Catherine Whitlock stays with us. Catherine, let us move on to Lise Meitner, who also lived through Nazi Germany, fled to Sweden, emigrated to the U.S. She's known as the mother of the atomic bomb, but her name doesn't come up about nuclear fission. What is her story?
Yeah, so, I mean, first of all, just to refer to that, the title, Mother of the Atomic Bomb, because she was absolutely horrified by that.
Right.
And she was a classic example of somebody who is working in, you know, what they call blue sky research now, you know, pure research that... the time when it's been done, does the implications of the science is not obvious. So she was working with Otto Hahn, who was a German scientist, and they were trying to understand this phenomena of radioactivity that Marie Curie and others had described, and Becquerel. And at the time, we tell the story, a very detailed story of how she had to flee to Copenhagen, and while she was there, Otto Hahn wrote to her and said, you know, we're seeing this weird phenomena where we fire neutrons, which are one of the subatomic particles of an atom. We fire these neutrons at uranium, and we seem to be getting more than one element that's coming out. We don't understand it. And it suddenly came to her on a walk in the countryside with her nephew, and they were just mulling over these results. And she saw these water droplets, and she suddenly had this idea that the uranium atom was like an unstable water droplet as it's falling off something. And effectively, the droplet splits into two. And she suddenly realized that that was what was happening, and that two new elements were coming out, barium and krypton. And most importantly, of course, for the atomic bomb, the release of a huge amount of energy. So she was really responsible for describing the process and understanding, you know, obviously some very detailed mathematical analysis behind all of this. And of course, she then became infamous really nowadays for the fact that Otto Hahn, her collaborator and partner in science, was awarded the Nobel Prize and she wasn't. She was no part of it at all.
But she had this aha moment when she realized what was going on with nuclear fission. But she wanted no role in the Manhattan Project. That was the project going on to develop the first nuclear weapons.
Yeah, because I think she realized how powerful they were going to be. She understood the science behind it. And people say that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were that people use the phrase they were credited with ending the Second World War, which may well be the case. But they may also have set up the Cold War and all the troubles that we had in the 60s, with the worries about nuclear bombs being used again. So I think she kind of had a vision, if you like, and I think she had a vision of the power of her science. And again, this is a feature that comes out from many of these women's stories. They were people who were working outside of the establishment. And so that had huge number of disadvantages because of their difficulties in getting their work recognized and from working at all. But the flip side of it was that they were kind of free to think. And I think that's, I think I find this when I'm writing myself, some of my best thoughts come when I'm in the shower, when you're free and you're not thinking too hard about the precise problem, you're allowing your mind to drift. And I think it's sort of the same thing with her. She had been ostracized to Copenhagen. She was very undervalued there, was given no lab space and no funding. But when she's on this walk and these amazing results come through, it just suddenly all clicked. She had the kind of mind that could process it and produce this amazing explanation.
Well, it seems like these scientists had not only the freedom to think in their own right, but the freedom to fail. They weren't looking at having to write their next reasoning as to why they were pursuing an NIH grant, for instance. They could just really dabble, right? And just kind of go where the research took them.
Yeah, exactly. So there was no, I worked in medical research for years, and increasingly so nowadays, you have to write your impact statements and show what the science is going to be used for. And so I think it does demonstrate, one of the things the book demonstrates is the power of having some freedom. Obviously, we can't fund all science ad infinitum, much as I'd love that to be the case, but there does need to be a focus. But these women were free to think outside the box.
What was her relationship like with Otto Hahn? How were they?
I feel she was very hurt, I think, that he was awarded the Nobel Prize. They did. He was obviously very worried about being associated with, there are all sorts of reasons potentially, but one of the reasons why he got the Nobel Prize and she didn't was that he was worried about being associated with a Jew and the implications that it would have for his work in Nazi Germany. And so they had a difficult relationship once she fled, but eventually they made up, and he recognized that she should have, really should have been had the recognition that he had. So I think we use the word partnership a lot in the book because the partnerships, various partnerships for these women were very, very important. And they fed off each other like many of the other partnerships. And that was important. So it was very much a joint effort. And we were keen to make sure that the book wasn't some kind of, totally kind of feminist monologue, and that it really did recognize that all science is collaborative and it has to be about joint efforts. And sadly, these Meitners wasn't recognized at the time, but it very much has been since.
We're learning about the women who changed science and their immense contributions to our world today. Catherine Whitlock is co-author of 10 Women Who Changed Science and the World. Are you a woman working in a traditionally male-dominated field, like in medicine or in the sciences, in STEM? What has your experience been like? What inspired you to become a scientist or a physician? Tell us about your work today. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email your thoughts to ideas@wpr.org. So, Catherine, Gertrude Elion, another scientist whose name is virtually unknown, one of the 10 in your book, but her work led to drugs that could cure childhood leukemia, major research in chemotherapy. What did Gertrude do?
Yeah, so she, I have to say, she was one of the names that I didn't know. And I think I ended up, when we'd written the book, thinking, really, this is amazing why I didn't know about her for a couple of reasons. So just a slightly sidetrack, the success that they had in their chemistry lab, she worked for Burroughs Wellcome. And she was really, her and George Hitchings, her co-worker, her partner in the lab, were instrumental in the success of Burroughs Wellcome. And they led to the huge success of the Wellcome Trust here in the UK, which runs a lot of medical research. I was amazed because I've been funded by the Wellcome Trust. I was amazed I didn't know about her for that reason.
Burroughs Wellcome is a pharmaceutical firm that eventually became GlaxoSmithKline. Is that right?
Exactly. Okay. And here, the offshoot from Henry Wellcome's, the investments from his will have set up the Wellcome Trust, which is, I think, the biggest medical charity in the world. So that all fed into the success of these things. So she can not only be credited with developing the drugs, I'll come on to that in a minute, but also the success of a major medical research charity here in the UK. So she and George Hitchings developed a new way of essentially making drugs rather than testing compounds that are potentially out there already, either in nature or already created. And she found a new way of really targeting DNA, the molecule of life that holds the genetic code, and disrupting that molecule to create new drugs. And really, the main drugs that she created were the ones, as you referred to treat childhood leukemia. So when I say disrupt DNA, I mean when cells replicate, their process of replicating, dividing. I don't mean going into disrupting fertility and so on. But she designed drugs for cancer and acyclovir, which is used to treat the cold sore virus, herpes, and one of the main drugs that's used for AIDS, AZT. So again, why her name hasn't come up in that field, I really don't know.
Huge advancements, yeah.
Absolutely. And one of the big immunosuppressant drugs, azathioprine, which is used in transplantation to suppress the immune system so patients don't reject the transplanted organ. So, you know, the list is endless. It's incredible, really.
We're talking about women trailblazers in science this hour. Catherine Whitlock is our guide. She's co-author of the new book, 10 Women Who Changed Science and the World. Still time for your observations about women in the science world. Who do you look up to? What female scientist would you like to recognize, give a nod to? We're at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. We'll be back in just a moment for more scientific advancements led by women right here on the Ideas Network. You're with us in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Next hour, we'll bring you live coverage of the congressional hearing for former special counsel Robert Mueller. That hearing beginning at 7:30. We'll bring you that NPR coverage right here on the Ideas Network. But right now, we're talking about the women scientists who changed our world. We're learning about their remarkable journeys and how they defied the odds to make breakthroughs and advancements in how we live today. Marine biologist Rachel Carson is author of Silent Spring. She died in 1964, and she's credited with having advanced the environmental movement.
Children born today are exposed to these chemicals from birth. What is going to happen to them as a result of that exposure?
Have you read Silent Spring or another book by a woman scientist that influenced your life or career? Join in at 800-642-1234. The book is called 10 Women Who Changed Science and the World. The subtitle includes five women who we learned much more about through our conversation: Marie Curie, Rita Levi-Montalcini, Chien-Ying Wu, and Virginia Apgar. Author Catherine Whitlock stays with us. Catherine, going back to Gertrude for just a moment and her personal relationships, both with her family and with the patients involved in her drug trials, what did we know about why she wanted to pursue this research and cancer in her own life?
Yeah, so I think that was a huge driving factor. So she, there were four deaths really in very close relatives or loved ones that propelled her into wanting to research new drugs, particularly for cancer. So her beloved grandfather, who was an amazing character, she was Jewish as well, they would speak Yiddish and tell stories of, you know, he came from Lithuania, she was very close to him, and he was an incredible influence on her life. And he died young and very painfully of stomach cancer. And the other death that was really noticeable, I think, was her fiancé, Leonard Cantor, and he died of bacterial endocarditis, so an infection of the one of the heart valves. And there were no antibiotics available. This is in the days before antibiotics, penicillin, was even invented or mass produced, and it was an entirely preventable death, as it turned out. And so she was absolutely driven to understand. Her father was a dentist. There was a kind of medical background in the family. And really, from a serendipitous finding, she managed to get a job in with George Hitchings, and her whole world opened up. And that's when she started doing this incredible research.
These scientists also lived in eras when it was discouraged, if not totally unheard of, for women to work outside the home, to do this science and have kids at the same time. And In your book, we see a college lecture with one of these scientists who was 8 months pregnant. You have headlines from the 1960s of Nobel Prize winner who's also a housewife. How do we negotiate that? What did we learn there?
Yeah, I mean, I find that I kind of gasped with amazement when I saw that headline. That's a Daily Mail headline, Dorothy Hitchkin here in the UK. Nobel Prize goes to housewife from Oxford, as if those things were noticeable. Being a housewife, maybe living in Oxford's vaguely notable if you live in this country, but certainly being a housewife was really not the thing to put in the headline. So, I mean, it's really something out of a comedy show. It can't possibly be real life. And this is the decade I was born in. How could that be possible? But, you know, she discovered the structure of penicillin and vitamin B12 and insulin over decades of incredibly minute and amazing work. So, great to have the fact that she got a Nobel Prize recognized, but it really almost reads as though she was getting it for being a housewife from Oxford. So I did find it very difficult to negotiate those headlines. We started the introduction to the book focusing on that, because I mean, in many ways, the headlines are useful, because that kind of headline is useful because it shows how far we've come. You know, there is still a lot of talk about inequality, but it's a hell of a lot better than it was. And that's really something to focus on, I think, and celebrate.
Yeah, but it is also almost the latest reference we have, because there has been so little activity among knowing and these scientists. Since the 1960s, we just see very little activity on that front of even recognizing more women doing Nobel Prize work. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's much better at all sorts of levels, but there are some fields where the inequality and the issues are still massive. And I think engineering, you mentioned medicine, I would say, well, certainly medicine here, at the lower levels, going into graduate school, it's about equal, actually. The issue you have, certainly in the UK, is retaining women when they have families. But the area that's particularly bad is engineering. I think it's something like some statistic like 5% of qualified engineers in the UK are women, which is something that has been recognised and something that there is a lot of work, I think, in the US and certainly here in the UK as to trying to correct that. There are all sorts of schemes that have been set up. The scientist who wrote the foreword for our book, Dame Athene Donald, who's a professor of experimental physics at Cambridge here in the UK, she is part of something called the Athena Swan Initiative. And that awards kite marks and effectively recognises and rewards institutions, universities, businesses, industries that promote women in science. And that feeds through to better financial, better funding for these institutions. So, you know, a lot of people have now got an inherent interest, whether it's financially driven or not, to create better conditions for women in science and recognise flexible working practices and so on. So it is hard. There is a lot of work to do, but I'm optimistic that we're going the right way.
Catherine Whitlock, let's break from history for a moment and look to the present. Two women were awarded Nobel Prizes in the sciences last year, Donna Strickland for physics and Frances Arnold for chemistry. What do we know about these women and their accomplishments?
Yeah, I think they're both fascinating for different reasons. So Frances Arnold, she's an engineer. In fact, both of these women are engineers by training, very different fields of engineering. But I think that's fantastic in itself, as we've just been talking about, the importance of having, the importance of having role models of engineers in a field that's very male dominated. And Frances Arnold, her work is amazing because she has been using directed evolution, a way of introducing mutations into cells so that they produce enzymes that can have all sorts of different uses in the pharmaceutical industry and tackling renewable fuel problems. So she's working in a really, really relevant and important area of research. And she's also, you know, a woman who's had to deal with tragedy in her own life, like many of our women do. You know, she's lost two husbands. Very tragically, her son died. And she's coped with breast cancer. And, you know, I think she is a living role model that mirrors some of the stories that we've told of our women who've dealt with family tragedies and their own ill health and have still, you know, arrived in a situation where they have been awarded a Nobel Prize. I think it's really important to focus on the Nobel Prize winners, but I think also we have to temper that by getting out there that you don't have to be a Nobel Prize winner to be a successful scientist.
Right, these scientists didn't set out to do that.
Yeah, of course they didn't. And I think, you know, I think sometimes the stories can come across as, if we focus too much on the Nobel Prize, of being a bit overwhelming to girls who are thinking of going into science. Scientific careers cover all sorts of areas and everyone has a part to play. It's a big jigsaw. It just so happens that these women are perhaps a bigger piece in that jigsaw than others, but it's very important to recognise that it isn't the only way to work in science to be a Nobel Prize winner. Yeah.
Catherine.
And to Frances Arnold. Fantastic. Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us, Catherine.
No, not at all. It's been a real pleasure.
Catherine Whitlock co-authored the new book, 10 Women Who Changed Science and the World. Coming up, we bring you live coverage of former Special Counsel Robert Mueller's testimony before Congress on the 22-month Russia investigation. First hearing is before the House Judiciary Committee. Second hearing before the House Intelligence Committee. We'll bring you full, uninterrupted NPR coverage, both hearings starting at 7:30. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show. This is the Ideas Network.